we continue our series this morning, Lent for Dummies, at least one of us here qualifies for that. That's me. And here I see another hand. Can I get another hand? We're talking about different moments and experiences and characters of the last week of Jesus' life. And today we're coming to the night that Jesus was on trial before Caiaphas, the high priest, and the Sanhedrin, the high religious council of the Jews. And the scripture is found in Mark 14, verses 53 through 65. It should be on the screens. This is New International Version's reading of it. They took Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests, the elders, and the teachers of the law came together. Peter followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest. And there he sat with the guards and warmed himself at the fire. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death, but they didn't find any. Many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. Then some stood up and gave this false testimony against him. We heard him say, "I will destroy this temple made with human hands, and in 3 days will build another not made with hands." Yet even then, their testimony did not agree. Then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony these men are bringing against you?" But Jesus remained silent and gave no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" "I am," said Jesus. "And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." The high priest tore his clothes. "Why do we need any more witnesses?" he asked. "You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" They all condemned him as worthy of death. Then some began to spit on him. They blindfolded him, struck him with their fists, and said, "Prophesy." And the guards took him and beat him. When we were working on this series, Pastor Jared and I, trying to think about the things we wanted to focus on, and we came to this moment in Jesus' week. And this trial, we settled on this scripture, and then Pastor Jared suggested the title of Insulting God. And I said, "What in the world do you mean?" But I read the scripture again and again and again, and it became clear to me that this whole piece is an insult. Now, insults are things that we're familiar with, many of us. Some of us are guilty of making them, others of being hurt by them. Sometimes there are things in insults that I can't help but appreciate. Being clever has always caught my ear and my eye. And if being clever happens to be at the expense of somebody else, there are times that I have fallen into that trap. But I found several clever insults that I want to share with you this morning before we go any further. When British Prime Minister Winston Churchill was talking with Lady Astor, the first female member of the Parliament, they were at a social engagement, and she told him he was disgustingly drunk, to which he replied, "My dear, you are ugly. But tomorrow I shall be sober, and you will still be ugly." These two must have had a strange, interesting relationship, because at another event, Lady Astor told Churchill that if she was married to him, she would have poisoned his coffee. To which he replied, "Nancy, if I were married to you, I'd have drunk it." Others not quite so classy, I don't know. Kurt Vonnegut Jr. wrote once in one of his novels, "If your brains were dynamite, there wouldn't be enough to blow your hat off." You know people like that? President Abraham Lincoln, talking about one of his political opponents, said, "That man can compress the most words into the smallest idea of any man I've ever met." course, in there, and there were the supreme at the, you know, at the insults like Groucho Marx, I never forget a face, but in your case, I'll make an exception. And the others not quite so classic, but things that some of us may have said on, I've heard they were said on playgrounds, I'll put it that way. I would never say that I said them, and I'm sure that you never did. But you know, when you were born, you were so ugly, the doctor slapped your mother. Or when you were born, you were so ugly, they had to tie a pork chop to your face because the dog to play with you. And there are many, many, many more. Now, all that being said, none of you would have ever said any of those things, would you? Never. Never. Thought them. Well, there's another scripture we're going to go to then about where sin begins. Well, you know, as we talk about insults, sometimes they're clever, sometimes they're just mean and ugly. But the nature of insults has at the heart of it the aim of wounding somebody else. Webster's dictionary, or I should say more correctly, Merriam-Webster's dictionary, now that it's got the full name, defines the word insult as follows: to do or say something that's offensive to someone, or to do or say something that shows a lack of respect to someone. And not to bring up any painful memories, but have you ever been insulted? Likely, when they were those hit very close, you still remember them. Aimed at you and wounding you. How did that make you feel? Were you angry? Were you embarrassed? Were you abused? Did it wound your pride? Have you ever insulted somebody else intentionally? What's at the root of it? Why do we do that if and when we do that? Do we do it to be clever? You know, there was a time in my life when I was young, 18 years old or so, I was really clever, and I was going to say something if it seemed clever, no matter who was the butt of the joke. And I would leave people slashed to pieces before I was done, but it was funny. The difference between wit and humor is that wit, which is clever, has someone usually at the target of it. So if you ever insulted somebody to be clever and not caring how you make them feel, did you do it out of spite or to get the reaction of somebody else for some reason? Did it come from a place of anger or personal pain within you? Well, today as we look at this scripture, we find ourselves witnessing Jesus on trial for his life before the high priest Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin, this high ruling council of the Jews, having the night that he was arrested and taken from the disciples. There in Caiaphas's house, the entire scene is filled with insult. Imagine it again with me. Jesus is there in the midst of this room of all these very unfriendly faces. He is bound, and there is this gap between him and those who were his accusers and judges. And they were trying to find something that they could hang on Jesus that would be severe enough to call for his death. But they could not find anything to charge him with. People began to make false testimonies, but their stories didn't match with others. They began to, and they talked about Jesus' statement one time that he would destroy the temple, and in 3 days build it back again, which is referring to himself. But even then, when they used that scripture, it didn't match, that statement, it didn't match. And finally, as Caiaphas was getting really frustrated they couldn't hang anything on him, he said to Jesus, "Why aren't you saying anything? What about these insults, these charges?" And Jesus didn't respond. And then he said, "Tell me, are you the Messiah, basically? Are you the one who is to come, the Son of the Blessed One?" And Jesus responded, finally, I am. And you will see the Son of Man, a claim, a name for Messiah. You will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. And Caiaphas tore his clothes, a sign of utter spiritual despair at hearing such blasphemy. He turned to the council and said, you heard him. What more do we need? And they all agreed this was what they needed to put him to death. They began to spit upon him. They blindfolded him. They struck him with their fists. They taunted him, saying, prophesy. And finally, when they were done, they gave him to the guards who took him out and beat him as well. It was a scene filled with anger and bitterness and outrage. Why were they doing it? You know, of all those people who were there, there had to be at least three different kinds of attitudes. You know, there's always different motivations and attitudes in a group of people. For those who were there, there were some who were there who I think were there honestly trying to protect God, speak up for God, defend God against a mere man who was trying to usurp God's place as deity. Their motives, however misguided, were probably sincere, I suppose. There were some who were there who were gathered with an agenda of power, full of themselves as they tried to protect their positions of privilege. They saw Jesus as a threat to their power and position and a threat to their beloved religious system of beliefs and practices. And there was undoubtedly someone there, there's at least one in every group, who just thrived on being offended. You know, somebody who just loves the drama and the anger. And they believed that Jesus' teaching and ministry were an insult to God, and their actions were somehow on God's behalf to protect God himself. But what really stood out for me in this story, in this scripture, was their utter misunderstanding. They confused their preferred view of things and their beloved religious practices with the person of God. What they thought was a heroic stand to protect God was really a frenzied defense of their religion instead. But before we go judging them too quickly, we need to remember that it's easy to equate church and God. For it's through the church that we experience many of those powerful moments that we have in our relationship with God. It's through the church and what the church offers that we find ourselves opening up to receive God's blessing. And so we think of church and our relationship with God being tied together. And so it's not hard to somehow equate the two. Not correct, but not hard to see how they would. But there is a difference. They aren't the same. You see, God is eternal, and God reaches down to us to raise us up to be in relationship with him. Religion is a human effort, an attempt to reach up to God and somehow make ourselves acceptable to God through our own merits. We design our religion with good intention, to be able to connect with God. But then we get enamored of the religion, the practices, the structure, and we add our own bells and whistles to make us comfortable and confident and proud. Religion is a noble attempt, and it can help us in our relationship with God, but it has no life in itself. The folly of those Jewish leaders, they thought in their passion they were protecting God, but it had nothing to do with that. This week, as I was thinking about how I would shape what I wanted to say, I turned to some of you on Facebook, and you didn't disappoint me as I asked two questions. I asked, do you think we can insult God? And if so, how or when do we insult God in our living? I got good answers focusing on at least two different areas. Some answers thinking of the ways that we fail to live up to our call as disciples of Jesus Christ when we act in ways that don't honor God Or when our actions are not consistent with Jesus' teaching, we insult God. I get that. And I'm guilty of that far more than I would care to admit. Others answered saying they were going to focus on the nature of God in the question, saying that God, who created us and knows us completely and still chooses to love us, is not so much insulted as God is disappointed when we act that way. And I get that too. As I've given some real thought to this whole thing about insults, it occurs to me there are a couple of requirements necessary for something that is said to be an insult. Not just the intent. We can throw things out there that never quite land, you know? The first thing is, if an insult's purpose is to wound the other, it usually is a wounding of pride. You hurt my feelings, you wound my pride when you insult me. But God's not caught up in pride. In 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 4, Paul writes, "Love is patient, love is kind, it does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud." So attempted insults aiming at God's pride miss their mark. The second is that God is big enough that he refuses to accept insults and is not affected by them. Such intended efforts fail in their target as well. Well, my kids were little. I mean, little, you know, five. They were kind of stair steps, 7, 5, and 4. My middle child, about every week or two, my daughter would come to me just in tears and sniffling and so upset, and she would be whining and she would be tattling on her brother, her older brother, Brad. Brad called me an ugly monkey. That was the word of the week. It was other things too. And I said, "I'm sorry." I said, "Well, are you?" And she said, "No." I said, "Well, good. Then he's wrong. Ignore him. Don't let him get to you." It's amazing how we allow ourselves to receive the insult. But God is big enough not to be drawn into it if we insult him intentionally or otherwise. God doesn't let petty insults wound him. We can see this in Jesus' actions at the trial that night. He was pelted with insults and accusations and lies, but he remained silent. Why? I mean, he knew the truth. He was the truth. Why would he remain silent? Because he didn't feel threatened. What took place there that night was part of the reason he came. Because he didn't need to win an argument, he remained silent. He hadn't come to debate. He came to sacrifice himself on his own terms, willingly, on our behalf. Their actions and attitudes that night were exactly the reason that he had come. He was trying to free them from those things through his death on the cross. The irony in this moment is that they had it all backward. What they thought was protecting God was really attacking God, both by attacking the very person of God's Son and attacking God's plan for their salvation. All throughout history, different religious movements have held and defended such beliefs that often strike out at others when those others don't agree with them, when those others don't act like them, when those others don't look like them. Convert to where the movement says they should be. They strike out at those others, believing they're being faithful to God as they stand against the unbelievers. But in doing so, they end up hurting the very people that they have been called, we have been called to, by God, to reach, to bring to faith, to experience the joy and healing of a life-transforming relationship with God through Jesus Christ. In doing so, they were acting like hammers, being wielded and crashing blows upon those they were called to love. If you visit a blacksmith's forge, even today, an old blacksmith's forge, you will likely, as you look around the room, you will find in a pile or scattered about old, scarred, cracked, broken hammers that have been used over a period of time in that blacksmith's forge as he was pounding upon heated steel to make shapes come into being, and against the anvil over and over and over again until the metal fatigue caused the hammer to break. And whether they're in a pile or whether they're scattered around, there are these hammers that through the years have been broken against the anvil. There was a man who was visiting in a quaint village and found his way to a blacksmithy. As he went in, he looked around. He, seeing some of these hammers, was thinking about all the work they had done through the years. And then he asked the blacksmith, who was moving from the bellows and the superheated ore and coming to put it on the anvil, he said, "I see all the hammers. How many anvils have you worn out over the years?" And he put that hot metal down on the anvil and turned to look at the guy, and he said, "Just this one." The anvil breaks the hammer. The hammer doesn't break the anvil. The truth breaks those who would try to do something of their own. They don't break the truth. Great preacher of the 19th century, Charles Spurgeon, once said, "The anvil's not afraid of the hammer, and God's not afraid of or wounded by the hammering pettiness of ignorant people." So let's bring it back to us for a moment. I mean, it's one thing to talk about that story that night, and it's compelling, and we are moved with the pathos of it. It's another thing to talk about those throughout history who have done some things in the name of God, protect God, but God doesn't need our protection. It's still good to think about the image of the anvil and the hammers, but let's get back down to us. As we continue in our 40-day journey through the Lenten season, seeking to clear the clutter that blocks our efforts to draw closer to Christ, are the things that we believe and do that insult or disappoint God? Do any of our personal biases or preferences muddy the message of Jesus Christ, making it hard for others to see God through us? Just as importantly, do we, you and me, ever confuse religion or church with God? Do we eagerly engage in debates and gear up for battle against others, those who hold a different understanding than we, against those who are called, we are called to love and serve and embrace for the sake of Christ? Do we ever act like gatekeepers? An image that keeps coming to me this season. Gatekeepers who feel it's our duty to size up those who come our way to the gate and to see if they're worthy to enter. Do we think that somehow we're protecting God from those people, whoever they happen to be? If that's our task, the question is, what are the measuring sticks? Well, those people have tattoos. Friends, you're sitting in the room right now with other people who have tattoos. I promise you that. And if we hold that to be our measuring stick, it wouldn't be too many years before our gate would be rusted shut from disuse. Or those people have body piercings, or those people talk differently than we do, or those people. The conditions we could name are endless. The problem with the measuring sticks is they are ours and not God's, and they move. When organs first were introduced in the church in the 16th century, is that about right, Greg, 16th century? I don't know. I know you are one with the organ, but I'm not sure if you're a historian of the organ. And I didn't check with him first, so I don't want to put him on the spot. But I think that's about right. Anyways, for any of us who are here, when they were first introduced in the church, they were considered instruments of the devil. Then they became almost sacred. Later, we fought the sacrilege of drums and guitars in worship. Oh my. And for a shameful period in our nation's history, people with black skin were denied entrance into white churches. The results? We performed our gatekeeper's duties well and successfully shunted those who were not like us down the road. And in doing so, we missed the chance to offer them the love of Christ. And we missed the chance to find ourselves being saved alongside with them in the process. God forgive us. What chances are we missing today? As Lent continues, I want to urge us all to keep looking honestly at ourselves for a way we might clear the clutter and open the path to the gate. We exchange our gatekeeper's uniforms for the clothes of those who are hospitable and opening the door to invite people in. Looking for ways to reach out to everyone God sends our way.